This is a Collider.com audio interview.
This thing's hero complex. It sounds more like a psychoanalytic.
Well, that's why we brought you here. Yeah, it's fun. It's a nutty brand, but thanks for coming out and joining us tonight. It's good to see you again.
It's good to see you again.
Yeah, and I meant that. That movie, it's so much fun to watch. And it's the music is fantastic. And you had Stephen Sondheim, obviously Madonna, Danny Elfman. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, music was a big part of the success of this film.
Oh, well, Stephen and I know for many, many years. And in fact, I'm such a fan of Sondheim's. You know, he just, every time I see one of his shows, I just fall apart in the first song. He did great stuff for this.
Yeah. And then Dick Tracy's a character, obviously this is the 80th anniversary of the character, Chester Gould's character, and there was a lot of interest in Hollywood in doing a film. There was different projects associated with it for a while, but you came to it pretty early on, right? 75, 76 or something like that, as far as being interested in it.
It was 1876. Yeah. Yeah. It was the first comic strip that I got involved with as a kid, you know. And it was, you know, Dick Tracy was the first non-funny paper strip, because it used to be they were all, you looked at the funnies, and Dick Tracy was not funny. He was serious. To some extent.
Yeah. People got shot. There was Tommy guns.
As people got shot, and, you know, times were tough in the Depression, and things had to be done, and so he went and did them. This picture does make me laugh, I have to tell you. I'm disgusting, because I really do like it a lot. I have to tell you, this is the brightest lighting that I have ever been. Is there a reason why you want to look like Vincent Price?
It's the only way I can compete with you, dude.
Do you think we can turn those off so I can actually see people?
I'm all for it.
Yeah. Or turn them down a little bit. I'd like to discuss how you came about this lighting decision. Right, now if you could take that one and just put it right over.
Ladies and gentlemen, Warren Beatty, the director.
Oh, I had no idea. I thought they were, you know, just a voiceover. So
you came to it, you grew up in Virginia.
Virginia.
Were you, give us a snapshot of you and Dick Tracy reading, you know, did you read the paper at the kitchen table, or? What did it mean to you? Did you love it?
I read it in the fireplace. Yeah.
Can we turn the light up?
Yeah, no, I read the paper. What can I tell you?
It was your favorite? Or, I'm just trying to figure out why you put the hat on.
Well, I thought it seemed like, you know, I think, you see, I didn't want to do some picture where everything got blasted around. I was interested in this old guy who was, who, you know, had been around for a while and sort of wanted to have a family. You know, that kind of got to me. I think of this picture as a rather gentle movie, and it is compared to, you know, some stuff. And, little by little, I found myself, you know, caught up in it enough to actually go and make a movie about it, which is hard for me. You know, I want to be careful because I'm dealing with the Los Angeles Times here. But I think I've said this so many times that it's lost its edge. I always think of making a movie like vomiting. I don't like to vomit, you know. But there, I get to a point sometimes where I think, okay, I better go ahead and do this, and I'll feel better. finally get around to making a movie. That is why I think, well, I'll feel better if I make this movie, rather than, you know, oh God, every day I got to do this. And when I looked at this movie, which I did earlier today to try to cope with my pathetic brain, I thought, I just like everybody in this movie. I thought Vittorio did a terrific job. I think Harrison Ellen Shaw did a brilliant job. Is John Shealy here? There you are. Okay. And Harrison, where are you? Are you here? It's nice to talk to you every 20 years. How are you? Give a coherent answer, please.
Or I could never be coherent around you.
I understand. It's really it's stunning the work you did on this picture, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
You know, and you watch this film, and the performances are great, as you say, as well. And tell us a little bit about Pacino on this movie.
Pacino, who I love, is... I'll tell you an interesting story. Los Angeles Times.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave. You'll just talk to you guys.
Well, I was having trouble getting an actor, the actor that I thought was right for it. And it was going on, you know, for a long time. And I was having lunch out in Burbank, and I saw Al, and I seriously thought, well, you know, Al, and I didn't have to get a star in the part, you know. So I went over to Al and I said, tell me some guys that we know that could play, and I described this part because I'm trying to get so-and-so. And he said, I'll have to think about that. And I said, well, okay. He said, can I call you at home? And I said, yeah. So I went home, and I remember I was on the treadmill or something like that. I was kind of working out, and the phone rang, and it was Al. And I said, what did you come up with? Because Al knows actors. Al really knows all everybody. And so the best people to ask about actors are actors. And I said, did you come up with anyone? He said, well, are you serious about this? I said, well, yeah. I said, no, I mean, are you serious about wanting me to play this part? I said, well, I am now. He said, well, tell me about it. And then I had what I consider to be a stroke of genius, because I had known that Al had done Arturo Uy, the Brecht play. And I knew that nobody much saw it. You know, I can't remember where he did it, but, you know, Al, he goes and does plays and whatever. I said, why don't you just bring what you did for Arturo Uy and bring that to this character? And you got to admit, that was very cagey of me. That's what he did. And he really is one of the funniest people going, because he doesn't do it to be funny. He knows it's funny, but he does it to be real. Al just did a great, great performance that I saw a couple of months ago in Merchant of Venice. Just he's just a great actor, and so there.
You know, in a performance that's not—he's not on the screen as much as Al, but he certainly steals the scenes. He's in Dustin Hoffman. Just does such a great job in this movie. Talk a little bit about what direction do you give Mumbles?
I don't give direction to anybody, but what I'm very proud of is when we were all very young. Al would walk out of a restaurant, and people would say, "Mr. Hoffman, could I have your autograph?" You know, and then Dustin would walk out of a restaurant and say, "Mr. Pacino, you were wonderful in The Godfather. Could I have your autograph?" So they're always confused. And so in the cutting room for Dick Tracy, we had a cartoon that was from The New Yorker. And the caption on the cartoon said, "If Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino are not the same person, how come I've never seen them in a movie together?" and they were in the movie together. The way I got Dustin to do it, he was always very fond of imitating someone that we both knew. And the imitation of the guy, and I won't say who it was because he's here with the Los Angeles Times. But he said, or at least till the end of this. The guy was, he kind of talked like this, you know, everything he said, you just talk like that. And he said, "You want to ask me another question?" Said, "Go ahead. Ask me a question." And I said, "Dustin, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use," and I said, "my imitation of this person who kind of talks like this. And, but I'm going to ask Harry Dean Stanton to do it." He said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "What?" He said, "You're not going to let somebody else do that imitation." And I said, "Why? What do you mean you want to do it?" And he said, "Well, yes." So he came and did it. And the funny thing about it, in that scene where he's being questioned by me, it was the night after that he won the Academy Award. And he had a fever of 102. Oh. And, you know, I did a lot of takes. I like that. And Kathy Bates, you know, was taking a letter with the recording beside, and she he had her in stitches. But, yeah.
And Dick Van Dyke, yeah.
I love him, and he could do incredible falls. You know, he would do a fall and not hurt himself. You know, and he hurt himself on this. So guilty, you know. I remember sending him a stair climber afterward because I felt, and now I'm feeling guilty right now. He's terrific. And well, go ahead. I don't want to take this over.
No, I think everybody would prefer you.
Okay. How have you been spending your weekends?
Right here in front of this light. So what about, you know, any movie that you direct, going into it, you have to make a thousand, maybe a million decisions. Going into this one, what would you say were the important choices you had to make? What were the big things that you knew you had to get right to pull off the movie you really wanted to make?
Well, casting is always the big thing. Casting to me is writing, you know. And as soon as you cast somebody, it is a rewrite. And even if you don't change the words, it's a rewrite. But a big decision on this movie was to use the colors that had come down from the rotogravure. Herbie Gardner was a friend of mine, and he had a strip that was published in the Daily News, the New York Daily News. And he told me one day that, you know, you had your strip and you did it, you know, and then you had a number for red, and let's say that was a one, and the car was red, and the flowers were red, and the hat was red, and so you put a one on the hat, a one on the car, and one on the flowers. Two, let's say, was yellow, and then you did the same thing. That's two, two, two. So, and they were primary colors, basically. So, so the colors were limited and very and primary, and so that was a big decision. And then there's also there's light, which will then change the color of you put a red light on your shirt, then it changes the color. And so marrying the light with the actual substance, the actual pigmentation of the things, was a kind of a big deal. And it was an interesting marriage between Dick Silbert and Vittorio Storaro. And we had all worked together on Reds before that. And they're quite different in their approach to things. And that was an interesting dynamic that I couldn't be happier with the end result, you know. And then that's not even to... also, you have to factor in Melina Cannonero, who did the clothes, and I think she did them brilliantly. And so there.
Now. You know, you always have such interesting things to say about film because you do know it as a producer and as a director and as a writer and as an actor. This movie, if you look at...
And dealing with the Los Angeles Times.
Turning into a full-time job.
Yes.
you know, this one seems to stand out as a different experience than most of the films you've made. I mean, you've had big successes in films, but this one with the marketing and the commercialism and it made you a little uncomfortable at the time.
Not really.
No.
The picture cost in the high 30s. And it was, you know, very successful. It did more than 100 million domestically, and it, you know, it's a very, you know, successful picture. It was very well reviewed. It was, had, you know, kind of treated people very nicely, you know, and the critics and you know the Academy and all that. And so where did you get that idea?
I wasn't talking about the commercial success. I was talking about the marketing, the all the products and the product placements and all of that. I was trying to talk about.
Yeah,
the film did very well. And it made $60 million on home video in the first 5 years.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know if you got a chunk of that because I think you know. Might
have been possible. No, I was very happy with my chunk. And it was made, you know, for, I don't know, a third of the cost of some of the other comic strip movies. So it was, but I never saw it as a theme park tentpole kind of movie. I thought of it as a kind of a story, which, you know, with a guy wanted to have a kid, and, which I did not long afterward, you know. Four. But it was a very a pleasant experience making the movie.
There's some really great whipsaw dialogue between your character and the Breathless character. Especially in those, like, the dressing room scene. It's just really fun.
Yeah. What was her name?
I can't recall.
She's a singer. She's great in it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And she's fun to work with. She's really... she's hilarious. And... I love the thing when she's singing and Al is, I could look at that over and over again, when Al is trying to make them all dance in a different way. Now he kind of slaps Madonna, you know, when he, it's funny. I Yeah. And Glenn Headley.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, it's a movie that, is it a movie that you thought you might be making a sequel to at the time? I'm sure.
I'm going to make it another one. And you can bring up whatever you want to bring up.
What would be your compass points as far as casting the lead role? What kind of actor would you want?
Romanian? I don't know. No, in fact, you might be. I know. I think it's dumb to talk about movies before you make them. I just don't do it. It gives you a perfect excuse to avoid making them, you know? And do you agree with that? I think I got a very positive response for that very beautiful woman here.
But you do play the cast of.
Wait, you have a movie that you don't want to talk about making. I can tell it. And you know that the more you talk about it, the longer you. It's him. It's his movie, isn't it? Do you realize how I've ruined your night? Yeah. How long have you been talking about it?
I'm just thinking about you playing Dick Tracy.
Oh.
That's what
I don't believe you, but okay. Thank you.
My first question with that, yeah. It goes so well, so I'm going to try it again. What would you, there was big applause when you mentioned that you would do a sequel. Tell us a little more about it.
No.
Have you started?
Oh, you know, you'd have to define start.
I would like to use your definition.
I take so long to get around to making a movie that I don't know when it starts. And I'm a very strong believer in the fact that when you're really doing good work is when you don't know you're working, and something just occurs to you, you know, and you say, "Oh, of course." And my problem is I don't know when I finished, because I want to get it. What I think is right, you know, and that's so there.
Sure. You know, with this movie, which is not a sequel, with that great ensemble cast, with the cast and crew that you assembled, it must have been a lot of fun. Give us a couple of snapshot memories, maybe some fun things that would help us kind of understand the texture of actually putting the movie together.
Say that again?
Tell us a memory of the movie, making the movie. Tell us something fun that you remember. When you think back, you think back more than what we see on the screen. Tell us about the production.
You got to get more specific, because otherwise I will tend to, and I don't know who here is going to quote me, and you know, the things that really you do remember, you shouldn't say. I'll try to be as cooperative as possible. If you can be specific in leading me into quotations that will appear in the new technology, and which I think we all have to be fearful of, to say the least.
You said earlier that you don't really direct actors. That's a surprising thing to say. Tell us your process then, when working with an actor like Al Pacino.
Well, you do as you're told. I mean, you do as you know, because Al would never tell you what to do. Wait a minute now. I can't see. I'll try to make this funny, and it's not right. Al works hard, you know, when he comes in, and you got a scene that's about, let's say, 2/3 of a page, and he comes in. So, Marvin, I have been thinking. So, I you know, what would you think if I came in the door and then I went and then I think of, and I said, Al, let's. 3 or 4 pages, you don't like it? It's too long. Oh, okay. You know, Al is completely a dream to work with. He's a dream to work with. And I have to say, everybody in that movie is. So what you do is you, if you're an actor, I think you learn to respect actors maybe quicker than if you haven't acted. Actors, I remember Kazan saying that to me when I was 22 or 20, and I spoke lightly about actors, and he said, you know, the older you get, the more respect that you'll have for actors. And I've always found the actor, let me put it this way, as a group, there is no group that is more intelligent than the actors, or who have more constructive suggestions than the actors, if you just listen to them. But insofar, when I said I don't direct actors, what I mean is I don't interfere with actors. I'm incredibly slow in the casting process, and I love to meet actors and find out what they're all about, because, you know, everybody, you know, the old thing about character is plot. Casting, particularly in movies, is character. So in a way, casting becomes plot. So if you have a certain actor in a part, see, he's turning to her now, and he's thinking about, see, I got you. Because I'm right. Am I correct? Thank you. So there.
What's the best day as an actor or the best day as a director? Which, how would you compare the two? Your best day as a director, your best day as an actor. Which would you look back on more fondly?
That's interesting that you, that's a good question. here's what I find, and it's ridiculous, but when I've had a really good day as a director, and that's usually when I'm not in the scene and I think, wow, this is terrific, I don't like it very well when I see it as much.
Because of your expectations.
I don't know what it is. And then if I'm in the scene, when you're in a scene and you're directing, which theoretically cannot be, you're an actor too, right? Well, that's the thing. If you are theoretically, you can't act and direct at the same time. It just turns out that sometimes, or it's better than the alternatives. So it's the job of an actor to be at least somewhat out of control. It's the job of a director to be at least somewhat in control. So if you are somewhat out of control of being in control of being out of control of being in control, you know, it's a problem. And but as I said, it is sometimes better than the alternatives. And at least you know you have one actor that sort of agrees with you. Not always.
Yeah. Do you want to take some questions from the audience?
Yes.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to take some questions from the audience. Please make sure that they are questions, that they actually end in a question mark.
And they must all be flattering.
No pitches, proposals, threats, declarations of self.
I'm up for any questions you ask, and I can handle
it. Hey there.
The one right here.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things in the movie is the kid, and how you get such genuine reactions out of him, and just performance, especially when you give him the watch, him stammering, his genuine excitement, and kids are fucking difficult.
And what?
They're difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fucking difficult. How do you get that out of an actor like that? That's so
no problem. He is a good actor. Charlie is now, he worked in Washington for a congressman for a while, and now Charlie is teaching law. And he was a smart kid, a really no-nonsense smart kid. I didn't have to, you know, get anything out of him. He just was there.
I think we have one back there.
Yeah, I read it on the internet a few years ago.
That
you were interested in doing a director's cut. I was just wondering if there is some actual director's cut that already exists, or if there's any truth.
I don't know this term that people throw around, director's cut. I don't know what they're talking about. I've always had final cut of anything I directed, and also I always go to the person who was silly enough to greenlight the movie that I direct, and I say, tell me what changes you'd like to make, because I'm up for an argument, and if you convince me, I'll make the change. And I have never had anybody ask me to make a change that I didn't. Let me put it a different way. I've never had somebody linger on a change that they thought that I didn't honestly talk them out of. I had a terrific relationship with Jeffrey Katzenberg making this movie, and so I got to the end of the movie and I had final cut and I said, Jeffrey was just heroic, I thought, in his support. He very good with filmmakers. And so Jeffrey, I said, so let's, I said, please come into the cutting room, look, finish the picture, and tell me whatever you'd like to cut, and I'll what change you want to make, and I'll think favorably about making the change. And so he came in. I said, what time do you want to do it? He said, can we do it at 4:30? And I said, sure. I said, do you want to have dinner afterward? He said, no, 4:30 a.m. So Jeffrey came to the cutting room at 4:30, and he looked at the picture, and he said, I've got no suggestion. But there was just one thing, and then I argued with him. Then we talked about it for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then he said, well, okay, you're probably right, keep it the way it is. And last year I decided he was right.
Did you call him?
I did.
Tell us that phone call.
Oh, no. Jeffrey, when the picture was out, Jeffrey wanted me to make a sequel. And I said, I don't want to do a sequel. I mean, this is silly. It's when I was getting Bugsy ready, and so I didn't. And then time went by, and I have to commend you on your diplomacy in not bringing up the problem with your esteemed parent company involving the rights to Dick Tracy.
We're not done yet.
Oh. But, on Reds or on Heaven Can Wait or on Bullworth, I never, you know, making a movie is a group experience, no matter how much anybody wants to deny it. The whole business about auteurship has to do with other things that might involve complex. So I think what you do is you try to surround yourself with people who will be not afraid to say what they think, and that's what kind of makes it fun, you know. It keeps it from being It's a lot of work.
All right. And, of course, that legal decision, you won a lawsuit or a legal deal with Tribune. That,
I had a problem with the Tribune Company, and I'm slow, you know, and I guess the Tribune Company is faster than I am. And so it took me a while, but the rights came. Do you notice how I stuttered on that? The rights came back to me, and so I'm going to do it. This gentleman here I know has a question.
Director Early, I've always thought that the choice to go with the really strong makeup effects was a really inspired choice, and I don't know in pre-production if I would have had the courage to say, oh, I think an audience will accept this. What did that decision come early for you?
Very early.
And
yeah.
What made you decide to go that?
The very early, along with the primary colors, which is... I can tell you a funny story. The elevator operator at the Carlisle. You know, I would get into the elevator with him, and he'd say, "Mr. Beatty, that movie you had, that Reds, that's a great picture, and that's a, you know, I know you won the Academy Award, you know, as a director, but that other picture where the guys are running around in their underwear, he says I don't know why you didn't." He said, "That's just." And he said, "That's a great picture." And I said, thank you. And so I got into the elevator with Annette. This is, you know, and I wanted to show her his candor. And so he said, "Oh, Mr. Beatty, that Bugsy that you did, the two of you, you're so good. Really, so good." And I said, "Thank you." And he said, I said, "Let me ask you a question. What did you think of Dick Tracy?" And there was a long pause, and the elevator's going up, and he says, "Well, I got to tell you the truth." He said, I thought the scenery was a little phony." So, you know, so I think in relation to the makeup, you make a contract at the beginning in order to establish what I would call a willing suspension of disbelief on the part of the audience. So in the first scene, I wanted, you know, little face, you know, the guy with the big head and face, and I thought, oh, that's the game we're playing. Oh, okay, this is not supposed to be, this is not written by Paddy Chayefsky. I think once that agreement is made, you go along with it. Now, Joe, who runs the elevator, he didn't make that agreement. He didn't agree to it, you know. You know, he said, "I like Mr. Beatty, but a little phony." And that comes up throughout the movie. I was surprised because I looked at it before I came down here, and it's embarrassing how much I like. I just sit there and think, "Oh." But I was surprised at the number of double entendres that are, you know, left in. You know,
Quite up top here. And of course, the movie won 3 Oscars, one for makeup and one for art direction as well. Yeah. So, back there.
I'm Ms. Bay. My question is, when you did Bonnie and Clyde, which was awesome, the woman who plays Tess's mother, I think I wanted to ask you, did you cast her? Because I believe she was in Bonnie and Clyde as well. Yeah.
You mean Bonnie's mother?
Bonnie's mother, yes. Yeah, Bonnie Parker's mother. Did you cast her because, you know, you both worked so well in Bonnie and Clyde, or like...
Estelle Parsons. About Estelle Parsons.
Estelle Parsons, yeah.
Who played Tess's mother.
Tess's mother, right.
And she's just a great actress. You know, Estelle is not only a great actress, but a great teacher. And Michael Jay was also in Bonnie and Clyde. I also did a play with Michael Jay when I was 21? Yeah.
There's a lot of practical and optical effects in this, and nowadays, these kind of stylistic movies, which this is a precursor to like 300 and Sin City and all, it's all digital. Would you, if, when you're making your sequel, consider doing more practical and less digital effects as an evocative homage to this movie as opposed to doing it all digitally?
That's a conversation that I have with John Sheely and Harrison Ellenshaw and Vittorio, and the conversation goes on and on and on and on. I can tell you that the matte paintings that Harrison and the whole group at Buena Vista, what can I tell you? They move me. You know, I really, and I think, Harrison, were there 86, 89?
89.
Okay, it wasn't 86. It was 89. 89 matte paintings.
I can't, Warren, I can't remember. I just...
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think it was 89. I think it was 89.
You have an attention to detail unlike anyone else I know in the business.
Ah, that's a very nice way of saying I'm obsessive compulsive.
It's a complex.
Thank you, Harrison. Talk that out. And say it doesn't cost any more money. You know, it's just that it's good. And thank you. But thank you. I have some funny stuff to tell you later.
Just here. How much of the old cartoon did you try to emulate and maybe stray away from?
The comic strips, the villains, clearly.
Well, I don't mean the newspaper or comic book, or I mean the cartoon. That, like, you know, animated.
The
cartoon that, like, all of our parents grew up with.
You're talking about the film, animated film?
Was that an influence at all?
Not really. We stuck pretty much to the newspaper. Yeah, the strip. Yeah. Yeah. You moved.
It's like an auction.
You moved your arm. What did you mean by that? Yeah.
I could ask a question.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, there's so many big names, or a lot of character names in all of the parts. Was that something you thought of in the beginning, or was it as the project went rolling, other actors were contacting you saying, I want to be a part of this, I want to be a part of this?
I don't understand the question.
Did you seek out all the big names in this movie? Or...
You mean the famous people?
I think that's what you... Yeah.
Well... Not because they're famous, but because they're good actors, and I think most of those people have become famous by being good actors. And
we're trying to load up with an all-star movie, though.
No. Yeah.
Are there any roles or projects that you? Well, are there any roles or projects that you passed on that you now have second thoughts or regrets and wonder what if you would have done them?
I never talk about things that I passed on.
Okay.
Except late at night.
Yeah.
Yeah. What an interesting thing. Do you know?
If you don't remember, it was great.
The critical reception to the film was very, very good. But I know it's a sort of blasphemy to not remember what the Los Angeles Times did. I don't remember.
What about the other question, which is that one was a good question, about, I meant it was a good question, is about, do you look back on any role and wish you had another crack at, or another any of your projects?
No. No. Regret is a waste of the spirit. There's some things that I regret, but not to do with the movies. Not really.
Mr. Beatty.
Yes?
We miss you on the big screen. You should make more movies.
Thank you.
And I just want to ask you,
yeah.
When you first showed Jack Nicholson the finished movie after he played the Joker, what did he think?
Oh.
When I showed
Jack Nicholson, well, you know, the summer before Batman came out and he played the Joker, you know, which kind of set the tone for the reception of this movie, you know, I want to say, in a way. And I just want to ask you, you know, from what I understand, you guys are very close friends, and what you thought of the movie when you first showed it to them.
Oh, so what did Jack Nicholson, who had been in 1989, Tim Burton film, think of this movie, I guess?
Well, I remember Jack saying to me that he was going to do Batman, the Joker, and does that conflict in any way? I said, no, not at all. The comparison with Batman was not a valid comparison. They're very different, and the sort of guiding emotion of the two films is very different, and Batman was a way more expensive movie and made a lot more money. I think the cost to the profit ratio might have been kind of similar. I think of Dick Tracy as not a very big movie. You know, it cost in the high 30s, and Batman I think was maybe three times that or something. I'm not sure what it was, but and I think Batman's a very good movie. I thought Burton really had the spirit of it, and I thought Jack was great in the movie. And no, I didn't see a conflict really. I think the comparison I don't think was Batman maybe. Should be more compared to Superman, maybe. Dick Tracy doesn't fly through the air and do things like that. There's more a higher level of willing suspension of disbelief required, I would say that. And I would say that Dick Tracy's a more sentimental, or let me put it a more positive way, has more sentiment. I cleaned that up, didn't I?
That was remarkable, actually. That was a very
thank you.
Sentence.
I'm glad that, and I feel, and I don't regret it in spirit. Or
can we turn the lights up again? We're going to take a couple more questions, gentlemen, right there.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, when you made this film, did you have any classic, like, gangster films from the 30s and 40s kind of in mind, like with those Raoul Walsh-style montages?
No. No. I mean, that's not fair to say no. The more accurate answer to that would be, I don't know. Because we don't know. And I do believe that you're carrying out around many, 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 many more times the amount of knowledge in your unconscious than in your conscious. And so you don't know what affected you or caused you to do this thing or that thing. That was a good answer.
I was just wondering, like, as you said, with the some of the racy dialogue and with some like the sort of on screen body count, did you have any issues with the rating process, especially being a racist?
That's a good question. Did you hear that?
No.
Regarding did we have any issues with the rating process, particularly because it was a Disney movie. What I would say is that the double entendre were not violent, and they were not
obscene, you know. They were just kind of Mae Westy, you know. And Tracy doesn't do them. I always thought it was a movie that would be appropriate for kids, but it's funny, now we talk about the ratings in an era when we are sort of kidding ourselves, when our kids have laptops that are very difficult to, I mean, we're living, I think, in a new technological culture that makes the attempt at rating movies somewhat archaic, and I don't think we know what to do about it, or we don't know the positive effects, we don't know the negative effects, and as a person with four kids, I'm mystified by how to respond to the internet. I don't think we know the depth of it. We don't know the effects on kids. We don't know the effect on the fact that children spend more time sitting than they used to, because if they're not looking at television, they're looking at the computer, and I don't know. I don't think we know the answers to it, but I do think that it's a long way from the days of Jack Valenti and the MPAA and I remember sitting in a screening room with a very nice man who was a Catholic church high up, and seeing a shot of Faye Dunaway running down the steps in Bonnie and Clyde, and running it back maybe 16 times, and where he was saying to me, that's her breast, I see her breast. And I said, no, that's not her breast, that's the blouse, and you know, she was clothed. And we ran it again, and then we go, no, that's her breast. And do you see? Well, wait a minute. Run that back a few frames. You see? No, that's a button. You think that's not her breast. That's a button. And the idea of that today would be a joke. I mean, I think, you know, we are still. In answer to your question, and you can see I'm kind of long-winded on this subject, in so many respects, we're still the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and that doesn't jibe very well with the technology. You don't have time to hear my full answer. Yes.
You said this was a movie about family, in a way, a man with
yes,
family.
Yes, very true.
And now four children. Mm-hmm. Do they like the film? What's their awareness level?
I'm telling you the truth. I don't know if they've seen it. I don't ask them, and neither does Annette. We don't ask the kids if they've seen a movie, if they want to see a movie. They say yes. If they don't want to see a movie, I don't ask them. Three of them saw Reds, because Reds is kind of I was honored one time by the Directors Guild, and I had to go down there, and they said, well, can we go? And then they went. But I don't ask them. They've seen stuff. But I don't suggest that they see it, and I any more than I suggest that they be in show business. You know, I think that's a thing that people have to make up their own minds about. So the question was, have they seen Dick Tracy? I don't know. I mean, it's not like I sit around playing my movies. and neither does Annette. We just don't do it.
Well, we do. We all do. And,
well, you should continue to do that. Any more questions? I've got, you know. Yeah, what's this?
I know you're not really fond of, like, making up things and behind-the-scenes features for DVDs.
Say it again?
That, like, behind-the-scenes things and making ups for DVDs.
Featurettes.
Featurettes.
Yeah, I know you typically haven't been that fond of them, but you did a great one for Reds. Would you ever consider doing something like that for Dick Tracy, given how sort of technically gorgeous the film is?
I don't know. I don't know. Because I had this conversation with Terry Malick a few weeks ago, because he's a good friend of mine. Did you see Terry's movie?
Yes.
And you know, Terry created a lot of commotion because he hadn't done an interview, you know. And I said that when I made Reds, I never did a single interview. It was a 3.5-hour movie. And if you had asked me, what's the movie about? I would have said, are you nuts? You tell me. Because to try to sum things up like that is, I think, reductive in a counterproductive way. And I think somehow to say, well, then we turned on the blue light, and then we decide the pigmentation should be... you know, if somebody came to me and said, "What did you do?" I you know, you can see I'm a talkative guy, so I, as long as I'm not on television, you know, I have no objection in talking about it, but to sell it, you know, like on the DVD thing, I think it's not. I don't like that idea very much. You know, there are years that go by. I looked at Reds not long ago, and I thought it's surprising that movie got made. And I remember thinking that when I won awards for it and everything, and I felt I should thank the corporate entity. Was willing to make this movie, Barry Diller, Charlie Bluedorn, Eisner, Katzenberg, and group of people. And when I saw Terry's movie, I thought, this is good that this movie got made. And it sort of cheapens it to try to dwell. I wouldn't want to be a critic and write that about it, other than to say this is good that this got made, any more than I would want to be a critic of painting and go into detail about pointillism or something. You know, it either hits you or it doesn't, I think in answering your question, I'm turning against it. You know, I'm thinking, no, I don't think I... you just talked me out of it. You haven't said a word. Yeah.
Can you tell us if the sequel will have the characters that we love, like Cats and the Kid?
I couldn't quite hear you.
She said, with the sequel, will the sequel have Tess, the kids, the characters that we all love in this film?
I won't talk about it. if you want to meet me alone late at night, I've got a secret. That's but I don't make public. You know, I can't. I don't do it. Excuse me.
She said yes.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. It could be that you work for TMZ or something. I don't want to talk about movies that are not yet made. It's a mistake, I think.
Who's that?
You casted Mike Mazursky in a non-speaking role, but you were very deliberate in cutting to him a few times. And I was just curious, your decision in casting him. Are you a fan of his work or of the film era that he worked in, like the noir style?
I had met him, and I just always thought he had a great face. Excuse me. And the, you know, those guys that were sitting around the tables and things, great faces. So that's all I would say. They were a very good casting person named Jackie Birch, and she would have very good ideas and suggestions, and so that's what happened with Mike. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So, what's next on your list for your career, for your goal? What can we expect to see from you this week?
I won't tell you. But thank you for asking.
It's not that easy, is it?
No. Yeah. Yeah.
For someone as detail oriented.
Yes.
You talked about recap, or once you cast, you do a rewrite. How involved are you for someone as detail oriented? How involved are you with rewrites?
I'm a control freak. I
were there certain scenes because of this and Mr. Gould's original script? Were there certain scenes where, like, I need this image?
Well, Chester Gould didn't do a script for this.
I thought he said strip.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought he said script. So, are you saying how involved was I in the writing of the script?
Yeah. And the rewrite after cast.
Oh, totally.
I was just wondering what of your some of your favorite movies and performances the past couple years have been.
Oh, don't start me on that. Yeah.
Anything with Annette.
Good answer. That's very good. I removed my chapeau. Thank you. Yeah. And I'll tell you another thing. The Kids Are All Right, I think, is terrific. And she also made another movie with Rodrigo Garcia, you know, which was really such a good movie. And so that was a very good answer. Thank you.
I think we can only take a couple more, though.
How did it feel from going to playing a cop to playing a gangster in your following movie, Bugsy?
Well, Bugsy was required less of a willing suspension of disbelief. So it's more, I don't know if you'd call it realism. I think I would. And so they're just two completely different styles. And yeah. Well, you know, Barry Levinson directed Bugsy. Mm-hmm. I didn't. And so it's kind of more fun. I love working with Barry and Annette and terrific cast in Bugsy. And it's a different style of movie. It's not so choreographed as Dick Tracy. You know?
It's a fantastic movie.
I think it's a good movie, Bugsy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Way back there, there's one. Yeah.
Heaven Can Wait is one of my favorite films. Probably one of my top 10 films of all time.
Oh.
Can you speak a little bit about the collaborative effort and that you put in with Elaine May and Buck Henry? and what your collaboration process is and how you collaborate.
Is that all?
And that'll work.
Yes. I go on longer than people like to go on, as you can see. Do you see how he really wants to wind this up? Should we go to breakfast for everybody? So the answer is, Elaine is a great collaborator. She's a brilliant, and very, very funny woman. Buck came in. Elaine had to go off and do other stuff, and Buck came in because I like to bounce things off of people, and he came in, and I said, "Why don't you?" It's unlikely that the Writers Guild that will want to give you a credit for coming in. Why don't you come in as a co-director? And which he did. He's a tremendous amount of fun to work with, and quite brilliant. He was very good at keeping me from worrying, and so the collaboration is different with Elaine, and was different from. With Elaine and with Buck, and you know, also the actors are very crucial to how one collaborates. I believe I have somewhat of a theory that it's good to have more than two people collaborating on something, because sometimes you inadvertently, if you're collaborating with one person, you can slip into what I would call an ad hominem dialectic, in which you find yourself staking out a position, sometimes just for the sport of it, and it's good to have a third person, or a fourth person, or a fifth person to say, "Oh, come on, this is clearly the better way to go," you know. So that's something I feel is important in that circumstance. Not that two people necessarily get into an ad hominem adjustment, but sometimes that happens. And in a movie, you gotta go get it done, you know. That's a good question. Yeah.
I'm curious about your thoughts on the 3D boom that's going on right now.
3D. You're curious. So am I. I'm not going to go there. I'll tell you where I would go. Is the whole matter of what I would call variable ticket prices. I believe that it's nonsense that we charge the same price for every movie. And I think that it would accrue to the benefit not only of the producers and distributors, but also the exhibitors, to say, no, this thing we feel can be a higher price. The idea of saying, "Well, it's a higher price because it's 3D," I think is shouldn't be the point. So there. Yeah.
David.
But I can't believe nobody's asked this. Are there any plans to clean up and remaster the movie for Blu-ray, Dick Tracy?
Um,
Yes.
Thank you. I'll pre-order it in a second when it's
available. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to get out ahead of whatever they're doing, you know, whatever they want to do. Yeah.
It was reported that you filmed a special as Dick Tracy rather recently. Is that true? And are we ever going to get to see that?
I won't make a comment on that either. But if you'd like to meet me late at night. Yeah. I can tell you a funny story. Yeah, way back there. Yeah.
Could you tell us something about Bullworth, which I thought was a great movie? Woo! Yeah.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear anything Mark wants to say.
Well, that's so general.
Okay, tell us about the political context then and how it might relate to today.
Oh, boy. I had come, as you might know, I've had a kind of an active political life, and by the time I got around to Bullworth, I thought, well, if you don't do this funny, it's just, this is going to lead me into waxing on about what I feel we put our public servants through in the pursuit of votes and the importance of money and what it's costing us. And so I have too much to say on that. I have so much to say on that subject that I'm reluctant to give you some sort of answer because I don't want it to be boiled down. Someone will quote me being here, you know, and then he said this. And I want to be careful about what I say on that subject because I have very strong feelings about what we are putting people through who have the generosity to be willing to serve in public office. And I think we have to be very careful where we're going. And here I begin to start, even though I said I'm not going to answer. So I'm not going to. But if you want to meet me later, I'm afraid of being taken out of context in a public circumstance here. I have no idea whether Rupert may be sitting here, and I don't know it. And so I like it. Yeah, and I thought it was gutsy for Fox to make Bullworth. I thought it was gutsy. Yeah.
You said repeatedly that you don't like to talk about films before you make them.
Yeah.
I think it's bad practice. Does that have anything to do with the brutal and I think unfair treatment that Ishtar received back in the 80s? I think it's a terrific film.
I agree with you about Ishtar. And I can only tell you that that it was a very, very strange circumstance. I can tell you that before it opened, Dustin and I joke about this a lot because we had had three of the most successful previews that we'd ever had on a movie. And we just thought, this is a smash. And we came to Los Angeles for what they call the press junket. And Elaine doesn't like to do that. Elaine went to Tahiti thinking that
she will be modest about this and not have to go and, I mean, and I have to give her credit, just as I say, I give credit to Terry Malick saying I'm not going to do it, or to myself for not doing it for Riz or whatever. But now, I was after that, I began to face the fact that I have a responsibility in the marketing process, and I, you know, have to do it. But so the day that we came to Los Angeles after these previews, and it seemed like we had a big hit. There was a man named David Putnam who was running, who had replaced the man, Guy McElwain, who had decided to make Ishtar. And I did not know David Putnam, and Dustin had a bad experience with him on another movie. And he was a very energetic movie producer in England, and it had been David Putnam that had that had carried on a kind of a campaign who made the Chariots of Fire the year that Reds came out, and I kept reading things that I was a, you know, communist whatever, and I thought, where is this all coming from? Anyway, we came here thinking that we had this really good comedy. We had these big responses. And Putnam had done an interview with the Los Angeles Times.
It's on everybody's lips. That's
and it was an interview in which he sliced and diced Hollywood and the prices of films, the salaries of stars, etc. And it was really an attack. And Ishtar, he talked a lot about and said it had been so self-indulgently made, etc. And attacked Dustin and me and Elaine and everybody. And the Los Angeles Times appeared on the coffee table of every journalist in the country the morning of the screening of Ishtar. And everyone had read this attack on these self-indulgent, horrendous people and how much money they can... The funny thing about it is that Dustin and I had both said, just defer our money, and the movie company said, no, we won't, because we get a certain amount of money back from HBO or something, so we want you to take the money. Right. So I said, okay. So the movie, so this interview was on the coffee tables of all these people in these hotels. And that night, there was a screening where people would see the movie before they interviewed Dustin and me about the movie. And Dustin and I went down to the theater, this theater on Fairfax, off of Fairfax on Beverly Boulevard. And we stood in the back of the theater thinking we're going to hear what we heard in the last three screenings. We did not. It was filled with press who had all had this story. And we looked at each other and we thought, what is going on? We didn't realize that that was on the coffee tables. And actually, the critical response to Ishtar in major publications was kind of good. They said it's a funny movie. If you see it, it really was kind of sad, and there's this kind of reaction that you have is a kind of a common reaction to the movie. It's almost as if you know, Elaine wrote a very funny screenplay about two dumb guys who don't really know how to write songs, who wind up going to the Middle East and getting involved in things that did involve American hegemony in the Middle East, etc. And around the country, the reaction was, these guys are dumb. And their songs are really stupid, which was the whole point. And so it could be that Elaine's brand of humor was a little elevated for people who maybe didn't quite get it, having been proselytized by the Los Angeles Times. But that's that story. And so there.
Did Joe the elevator guy like it?
I never had the courage to ask.
Let's do an Ishtar screen.
Yes. Yeah.
You want to do that?
We'll get Dustin. We'll get you guys together.
Dustin would do it. And I'll tell you something else. Elaine would do it.
Because we'll do it for the LA Times. It'll be great. It'll be our apology screening.
Yeah, we can invite Sam Zell. But they had a tribute to Elaine up at Harvard, and they showed this Ishtar. This was a few months ago, and there was a standing ovation for the movie. And then she also had a screening at the Y in New York, which is, you know, a very, and the same thing happened. So
it was a groundswell.
A groundswell. And anyway, I could go on about it. She's really a very smart cookie, Elaine.
Yeah. If you get Dustin, we'll get Ishtar. You guys, what do you think?
Yeah.
Yes.
Just because there seemed to be some confusion before, I think we'd all love to see a sequel to Dick Tracy, but would you play him again? Which I think we'd all want to see. I know Jeff was asking who you'd cast, but...
I won't tell you.
My other thing is, I wanted to ask you, because I read about that Ishtar screen, and I was a big fan of it too, is I heard that the cut that she showed at the Y was actually a new cut, like a director's cut of it. Have you seen that version? And
That confused me. I didn't know. Let's put it this way. Any cut of calling it a director's cut confused me, because every cut has been Elaine's cut.
Right.
Nobody interfered with her on the original cut, I think she made a couple of slight changes for this screening. I think to call it a director's cut as if the other one wasn't, it was a misnomer. I don't know where that came from or why. But
So Dick Tracy made me fall in love with movies, and I was wondering what movie made you fall in love with movies.
Well, your question is so nice that then I have to answer the question where I would ordinarily say, oh, please, I'm not going to do that. actually moved me that you said that. So what movie made me fall in love with movies? I can tell you what didn't. I can tell you as a child that Fantasia scared the hell out of me. Which scared me. Scared the hell out of me. But I might say that Bambi really got to me. You know, Bambi really got to me. But then I can remember, you know, as stages, you know, every 5 years or so of the development, and then you think, oh, this has got me going. And so I'd have to name a whole slew of movies. But if I had to go back to the beginning, it would be one of the Disney movies, I guess. I liked Laurel and Hardy. I liked funny movies, you know, as a kid. So that's the way I would get off the hook on that. I have the feeling that it's time for breakfast.
Ladies and gentlemen, Warren Beatty.